All right, we are continuing our study through Matthew chapter 5. I appreciate Eric's prayer about praying for us to be good examples in the community and in those we come in contact with, because that's what we're going to talk about this morning. So the last 2 weeks we spent looking at the first 12 verses of Matthew 5, oftentimes called the Beatitudes, but we're going to move from that, and we're going to look at verses. I hope to make it 13 through 20 today. We'll see. We might not make it that far. We're already a week behind, so I guess it wouldn't be the worst thing if we're another week. But we're going to look at salt and light first, and then, assuming we have time, we'll talk about Christ fulfilling the law. Why don't we start by, let's just read Matthew chapter 5, 13 through 16, if someone would read that for us.
You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven.
All right, thanks, Matt. I think these two comparisons are connected. For sake of study, let's talk about them separately. I think you'll understand what I mean, why I think they're connected here in a minute. But let's just start with verse 13, and let's talk about the salt of the earth. I think it's interesting here that Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. It's not a command. It's not Jesus saying, go be salt of the earth, go become salt of the earth. No, that's not what Jesus says here. Jesus says to his disciples, Jesus says, Christians are the salt of the earth. Why do you suppose Christians are called the salt of the earth?
Well, salt has a very preserving power, and it preserves things from corruption.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good thing to look at. Okay, we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Are you talking about the tense?
No, just okay. Why is it that we're salt? Why does Jesus say you're the salt of the earth?
One of the things salt does is it spreads and permeates. You can put one grain of salt on your tongue and you can taste it because it dissolves. So,
okay.
You're supposed to be a light to the world and spread the good news.
Okay. We must be like related or something, because that's like my exact words. Christians make the world palatable to God. I think these are all good points. Let's talk about one that you didn't mention. Salt in the time of Christ was very valuable, wasn't it? Not like today. I mean, we manufacture salt. Probably every one of us has lots of salt available to us. We probably have too much salt available to us. And we have so much salt that we throw salt over our shoulder, something like that. But salt in the time of Christ was quite valuable. In fact, the Romans valued salt almost as much as gold. There was a Roman saying that says, there is only one thing more important than salt, and that is the sun itself. Salt was very important to the Romans. In fact, the Roman soldiers received salt as part of their pay. So they would work and part of their pay would be salt. And that's where we get the word salary from. The root word for salary is salt. And it comes from the Roman soldiers being paid in salt. And so there's kind of a funny saying, right? He's worth his salt. You ever heard somebody say that about someone? He's worth his salt. Well, what does that mean? Well, he's He's worth his pay. Because the Roman soldiers were at least partially paid in salt. So I suppose we could look at it in that way, that salt is valuable, and so we too are valuable to God. You know, later on in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus, talking about worry, says, "Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows." Remember, he talks about don't worry. God feeds the sparrows. And there Jesus says, "You are more valuable than many sparrows." In 1 Peter 1, 18 through 20, we're told, "Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold by the aimless conduct received by the traditions of your father, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot." So we know we're valuable to God, so much so that He bought us with the blood of His Son. So, I mean, that's one way to look at this. We're the salt of the earth in that we're valuable. Dwayne said that salt purifies. That makes a lot of sense, right? It wasn't that long ago that the only way to keep meat from rotting was to cure it. And how did you cure it? Well, you either cured it with smoke or you cured it with salt. And we still use salt to purify things. Emily and I have a, in our basement, we've got a water softener, right? What does the water softener do? It removes some impurities in the water that we have because we live on a well. Well, how does it do that? What is it that you put in a water softener? You put salt in a water softener. I don't know how that works. Chemistry is not really my thing, but somehow salt brings out the impurities. Wounds. How are wounds cleaned? You know, sometimes say, "Oh, rub salt in a wound." Well, yeah, it stings, but what else does it do? It cleans the wound. You ever had a sore throat? What do? Gargle with salt. Why are you doing that, right? To try to get the germs out of that. So salt has this purifying, this preservative impact. And salt removes decay. It removes the thing that's caused decay, water, bacteria. And so in some ways, maybe, you know, Christians are the salt of the earth in that they purify and preserve the earth. Here's the thing. These things are true. And I think we could make applications of these to the Christian life. We could have a lot of those conversations. But I think the context here tells us what Jesus is talking about. And the context is what Tad had mentioned. And that is, it has to do with enhancing or adding flavor or seasoning. It's saltiness. It's something about the taste. I'm not sure why Christians are like salt's flavoring attributes. I suppose it's like what was mentioned before, that Christians make this world a little more palatable to God. Maybe it's that when you eat something salty, what happens? You get thirsty, right? What did we just read about in the Beatitudes, right? That blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Well, maybe we live our lives in such a way that we make people wonder about this righteousness. Maybe we make them thirst after righteousness. James, do you have a comment?
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, it's about thirst. Yeah, maybe it's that. Here's the thing. I don't know that any of this is really the point Jesus is making. Because what he goes in to talk about next, you're the salt of the earth, but what? If the salt loses its flavor, its saltiness, if the salt loses its purpose, what good is salt? That's the point Jesus is trying to make. If salt loses its flavor, then it's good for nothing. Salt of the first century that was in Israel sometimes had impurities in it, oftentimes had impurities in it. And those impurities would leach out the saltiness of the salt. And so just imagine adding salt to food that didn't really have a salty attribute to it. What benefit would it be to you? Nothing. Well, what are you going to do with it? You ever thrown salt out on your yard? It's a good thing Emily's not here, because I'm going to tell this story. When Emily and I were first married, we made homemade ice cream. Like, we had gotten a homemade ice cream maker for our wedding or something. So we made homemade ice cream for the first time. You know, you put rock salt on it. So Emily, like, takes the bucket of rock salt and goes and dumps it in the yard. I I don't know exactly why that happened, but guess what the result was? Dead grass. For a very long time, I had to dig the dirt up. So salt that loses its saltiness still has negative effects on the ground it comes in contact with. So it's good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled, like put in the pathway where you don't want things to grow. So Christians who have lost their purpose, I think this is the point Jesus is trying to make. Christians who have lost their purpose are of very little value. So what is the purpose of a Christian? Well, that's why I think these two verses are tied together. Because the next verses tell us what the purpose, or at least in this context, the purpose of Christians, and that is to be a light to the world. Now, before we look at being a light, let's consider one other passage that compares the Christian life, or at least part of it, to salt. Let's go to Colossians chapter 4. And if someone would, let's read Colossians 4, 6 through 8.
Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one.
Okay. That was six. Was that six?
Yeah. Oh, did you say?
Five and six.
Oh, five. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you know how you ought to answer each one.
Okay. So here the context is how we relate to people who are outside. Well, meaning those who are not part of the church. How do we relate to them? Well, at least in the way of speech, the comparison is again here with salt, that our speech is seasoned with salt, that we know we might know how to answer each one. So we're supposed to have a seasoned speech, not a salty speech, right? We know people who speak salty, right? You ever been around somebody who has a salty vocabulary? That's not what the Lord wants us to have. Have our speech seasoned with salt. Why? That we might be able to answer each one. We need to be able to tell people about Christ, why we live the way we do, why we believe what we do, and in that way we're lights to the world. I'm not sure you can make oatmeal good, but I'll take your word for it. Okay. Maybe that's what's been wrong all these years. I didn't put enough salt on it. Oh, no. You're right. You're right. Seasoned with salt. Yeah, the point there is a little salt is a good thing. A lot of salt can be a bad thing. Yeah. All right. Other comments about us being the salt of the earth.
You'll probably get to this in a little bit, but Matthew 5:16, I think, is the summary of all of this discussion, is that salt or light, both of them, the purpose is that others will see, and the end result, the ultimate conclusion is more people will glorify God.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's a work, too, which is an interesting comment, you know, as you're thinking about, show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith by my works. There's something active and purposeful, as you put it, that needs to be done in our lives, similar to salt.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. This is why I think these two passages, you kind of have to look at them together to understand the example that Jesus is trying to, or the comparison Jesus tried to make. One other thing about salt, unless there's anything else, is who are we the salt of? We're the salt of the earth. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? All right. What does this tell us? We're not the salt of the church, right? We're the salt of the earth. We're the salt in the world. And so there's something to be said there, that salt left in the salt shaker doesn't do any good. Oftentimes we think, well, you know, how great it would be if we could just all be with Christians all of the time. Well, that would be great, except what kind of effect would we have on the world? We would have no effect. The point of all of these passages is that we're supposed to have an effect on the world. We'll talk about that here in a little bit too. All right, other comments about being the salt of the earth? Okay, let's move on and talk about the light of the world. This is verses 14 through 16. You are the light of the world. The city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So when I think of the light of the world, I think about two passages. I think about this passage where Jesus says, we're the light of the world. And then I think about another passage. What passage might you think about when you think about the light of the world?
John.
John, all right. So we could think of the whole book of John, but what part of John are you thinking of?
The first chapter.
All right. Yeah, chapter 1. So my mind works in some ways the same way as Eric's. John chapter 1, verses 4 through 9. In Him, this is talking about Christ, in Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, and all through him might believe. And he was not that light, but he was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. So here John the Apostle, speaking of John the Baptist here, but John the Apostle says that John, that Jesus is the light. Not just any kind of light. What kind of light is he? He's the light to the world, but what's the qualifier to light? He's the true light, right? He's the true light. And so, in fact, Jesus himself, throughout the book of John, John records that Jesus calls himself the light of the world. There's at least four other times in the book of John that Jesus is either calls himself or references himself as being the light of the world. John chapter 8, verse 12. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. John 9 and 5. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. 12, 35 and 36. Then Jesus said to them, a little while longer the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of the light. These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. And then 12 and 46, I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. So if Jesus is called by John the true light, and Jesus himself says that he is the light to the world, how is it that we also can be lights in the world?
Well, there's a passage that goes along with that in Hebrews, I think explains some of it, is that light has to have a source, an origin, and the actual light is what is given off by that source. And so if Jesus is the light, what's the ultimate source that he is coming from? And I think that's the Father, which is spoken of in Hebrews, speaking of Christ, who is in the beginning and created the world. It says in verse 30, who being the brightness of his, God the Father's glory, and the express image of his person. So I think that, you know, you have the source in God the Father, and Christ is the brightness of God's glory that shines.
Okay. So what's...
We're like the moon. We reflect with the sun, the source being the actual physical sun, and it reflects off the moon, and we show light, and I think that's a comparison.
Okay.
Were you going to mention Ephesians 5?
Eventually, but why don't you go ahead.
Well, you were just kind of asking about, you know, in general, where does light come from, what does it do? Part of the purpose of our light is explained in Ephesians 5, starting verse 8. Darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, with the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. Never so light is what I was thinking of. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. I was just thinking how, you know, we think of ourselves as being light as a good thing, which it is, obviously, and something that might normally be appreciated, but sometimes the light maybe has the opposite effect. It makes things visible that people would rather not see.
Yeah, there's lots of examples that we could look at with that, but You know, if you've been sleeping, how do you feel when the light turns on? You're kind of annoyed by it at first, aren't you? And those who live in darkness, yeah, the light has an exposing factor that might not always be appreciated. But the flip side of that is, you ever tried to work where there's no light? I've worked with Mike enough times that I know that if I'm going to work with Mike, we better have some light. Because if not, it's hard to work. You can't see what you're doing. So light has an exposing factor, which in some ways can be negative to those who want to live in darkness. But yet, if you're trying to work in the light, then the light is a positive thing. I think John chapter 1 in some ways helps us understand how this relationship is. You know, Bob described it in a way of where we reflect the light. I think that's a good analogy. I think the only thing to be concerned about is Jesus does say we are the light. So there must be something else there too. In John chapter 1, John the Apostle talks about John the Baptist and says that he came to bear witness of the light. And that is in the same way that we also bear witness in the way that I think is being described here in Matthew chapter 5. You are the light of the world. And it goes on and it talks about in verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify who? Glorify God. Well, so what are you shining? Well, you're shining the light of God is probably a good way to look at it. Okay, let's get back to the question of how are we lights in the world? So when it says you are the light of the world, just like it said you are the salt of the earth, when Jesus says you are the light of the world, how is it that we're the light of the world?
Doesn't he answer that in verse 16, that they may by your good works?
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously other ways that we're lights, but the big thing, the fundamental thing is by our works.
Yeah. So it's our actions, isn't it? We are lights in our action. I think we need to remember that. So, when it says that they may see your good works, what are we talking about here? What good works are we talking of?
Well, loving thy neighbor as yourself. I mean, Paul said, be imitators of me. I am imitators of Christ. So, in a sense, you're trying to imitate the light as best you can.
Yeah. I really struggled with how I was going to talk about this because I'd like to give some specifics. I thought, well, maybe Matthew chapter 25 is some specifics there where we see the sheep and the goats and the story there that says, come you, blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked, you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. Maybe those are some examples of some good works we can do. But I want to touch on something that Matt said that I think might be right, just as an example. So you said, love your enemies, right? That's a strange thing, isn't it? Neighbors? You said neighbors? Okay. Okay, so later we're going to read about loving your enemies. But the same principle, love your neighbors, love your enemies. What's the natural inclination of the world? Well, certainly it's to love the people who love you, not necessarily love people because they're people.
Love yourself.
Love yourself, yeah. The difference between light and darkness is as different as things can be, aren't they? I mean, when we say things are really different, what do we say? Like, there's a difference between black and white, right? Light and dark. I mean, we use those to compare how different things are. We're supposed to be light. I wonder. I just don't know. I wonder if what's trying to be brought up here is we're to be lights in the world that we are so different from the rest of the world that the world can't help but notice us. Right? That's the point here that Jesus makes in verse 14. He says, a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Right? You ever seen a light at night? Can you miss that light? How are you going to hide that light? You cannot do it. A city set on a hill, people are going to be able to see it at night. And I wonder if that's the message that Jesus is saying here. Be so different from the dark world that people can't help but notice it. So, I want to talk about a couple of other things. I got totally off my notes there. Sorry about that. Let's look at Romans chapter 12. And bear with me as we kind of go through this. This might be another way that we can be lights to the world. In Romans chapter 12, someone read verse 18 for us. Or maybe you just know it. It's probably one of those ones you've memorized. Romans 12, 18.
If it is possible, as much as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men.
All right. So, as Christians, what are we called to be? We're called to be people of peace. We talked about peacemakers, right? And the context of peacemakers is probably a little bit different than what's being made being mentioned here, but certainly both are true. We are to live at peace with people. Now, Paul later equates our peaceful nature as exemplified by not complaining or causing contentions as being light. So let's go to Philippians 2, 14 through 16. We'll see this. Paul writes to the Romans and tells them, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Then he writes to the church at Philippi, and somewhat talking about the same thing, about our relationship with other people, how we have this peaceful nature. He talks about it in the form of not complaining and not causing contention, and then equates that to being lights. So Philippians 2, somebody read 14 through 16.
Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the light, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain.
All right. So Paul here makes this comparison that when we do things without complaining, without disputing, without causing contentions, that the world will see this. Because the world is crooked and perverse, and in that way we shine as lights. So, kind of bringing all of this back together, how is it that we're lights to the world? We're lights to the world in our actions, in what we do. In our good deeds, but not just our good deeds, just in how we behave. And really, how we behave should involve good deeds. Whether those good deeds are things like are mentioned in Matthew chapter 5, or things that are in Matthew chapter 25, or things that are mentioned later on, like in chapter 6 and 7, where he talks about love your neighbors and love your enemies. Whether it's those things, when people see us, we ought to be like a city set on a hill. People ought to take notice. Have you ever been around someone who just, you're like, man, I just really wonder. I wonder if that person is a member of the Church of Christ. And you ask them, and sure enough, they are. There's just something recognizable about that people who are serving the Lord the way the Lord would have them to serve Him, that they are lights to the world. I have some more to say, but let's pause. Any comments or questions up until this point?
I was thinking, too, of one of the songs in our Red Songbook, Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. And we don't have a lot of lighthouses here in Missouri, obviously, but you go to Michigan, the Northeast, on the coastline, and if we were given this lesson up there, everybody would probably think of lighthouses, and the purpose of those is to warn people, warn sailors of danger, and that they're getting too close to danger, and to also to help navigate the way. So I think that, again, there's a purpose for Christians to, as Tad was alluding to warn other people about impending dangers that they may not be aware of that we are. And your other comment is that you can see lights from a long way away. The purpose of those lighthouses is designed to concentrate that light and to really help people see it from a very long distance.
Yeah, so relative to your first point, the Christ often describes the world and the sinful nature as and Paul does the same thing, as being dark and darkness. If we just get to the heart of the matter, people are blind They're blinded by sin and don't really know where to go. When Christ tells us that we're the light of the world, he's telling us that we're the ones who can show people where to go. Though Christ is the true light, true disciples are beacons of light, like that lighthouse that shows salvation to those who are in darkness. Consider what Paul says of himself and Barnabas relative to this conversation. In Acts chapter 13, verse 47, Paul talking about himself and Barnabas, quotes a passage, I believe it's from Isaiah, where he says, "For the Lord has commanded us, I have set you as a light to the Gentiles, that you should be for salvation, that you should be for salvation to the ends of the earth." What's the point here? Jesus is saying, or Paul is saying, that this prophecy, this saying that the Lord commanded us, that you're going to be a light to the Gentiles. And why is that? So that you can bring them salvation. So we're lights to the world in that same sense, that we show people the way of salvation. All right, any other comments there? Yeah, good point. All right, I think it's interesting here that Jesus in his conversation about light sort of goes back to this idea of uselessness. Remember he talked about it with salt? He said salt that loses its seasoning, its flavor, its purpose, it's good for nothing. I think it's interesting that Jesus also does the same thing in verse 15. You don't take a light, a lamp, and put it under a basket. You don't hide a lamp. Well, why would you do that? No, instead you put the lamp out in the middle of the room so that everyone can see. Jesus describes here the light as being hidden, just like he talks about the salt losing its flavor. I think it's interesting to ask us a question. Are you hiding your light? The difference here is that this is a deliberate thing, right? With the salt, you know, maybe salt loses its flavor over time. But if you have a light, Jesus here is describing this as a deliberately hiding the light. Because Christians will naturally stand out in the world. And why is that? Because the world is full of sin and darkness. A Christian will be like a light on the hill. And so it takes a conscious effort to hide the light. A Christian who does not stand out is one who hides his light. And 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 15, we talk about, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness?" When you hide your light, what are you doing? You're communing with the darkness. "Oh, I'm this light, but I don't want to be the light. I want to be dark. I want to be like the dark." And that's not the way that we ought to behave. In the end, all of this serves one purpose, and that is to glorify God. People will see our works and yet not glorify us, right? Who are they glorifying? They're glorifying God. We want these deeds to be seen because they are good, but in the end, we want them to glorify God. In John chapter 3, verse 19 through 21, this is what we read, "And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practice evil hates the light, and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen, that they have been done in God." There's lots to draw out of this. The first thing I always think about is what my parents always told me. I'm sure your parents may have said something different. The time might have been something different, but I can remember my dad saying, "Oh, nothing good happens after midnight." Okay, all right. Well, why does he say that? Why did your parents say nothing good happens after dark? Well, you think of the wickedness that happens during the day compared to the wickedness that happens at night. Why is it that more wickedness seems to happen at night? You can't be seen. That's right, you can't be seen. Or at least the perception is that you can't you can't be seen.
There's less eyes to see.
Those
people are asleep.
Yeah, that too. And so wickedness is compared to being done in the dark. And so here, the deeds that you do, when do you want to do those deeds? You want to do those deeds in the dark because they're evil and you don't want people to know that they're happening? Or do you do those deeds in the day so that people can see them and then in turn recognize that they have been done in God? That's what verse 21 is saying. He who does the truth comes to the light that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God. A Christian's work is to be done in such a way that the glory goes to God, not to the individual. Now, we'll talk about this in a couple of weeks, but in Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, it talks about this very same thing. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Likewise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. It's an interesting balance here, right? Here in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says, do your deeds in the light so that people can see that your good works and glorify God. But then in Matthew chapter 6, he says, don't do your deeds in such a way that you get glory brought upon yourself. I think there's certainly a balance there about how and the purpose and our intent in doing something good. It should just be our nature to do something good. And when you receive praise for that, you do the same thing that you're doing with the light, right? You have received the light from Christ and you're reflecting it to others. And so when you receive honor, glory, praise, whatever the case is for doing a good deed, what do you do with that? You send it right back to the source. And I know there's lots of people who are very good at this. When someone says, thank you so much, this is such a wonderful deed. And what do they immediately do? They give God the glory. That's what we're supposed to do. And when that happens, people immediately recognize this person is a light to the world. Bottom line is that both of these, the salt and the light, tell us that we as Christians are supposed to have an impact on the world around us and a positive impact. All right, that finishes that up. Any other comments on that?
This is kind of what Jack Yost was trying to talk to us about.
Yeah.
That's his really.
That's right. Good point. Okay, let's look at Matthew 5, 17 through 20. We'll take just 2 or 3 minutes and look at this. Do not think that I came to destroy the law and the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever does and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Let's just touch on one point on this, and then we'll pick up the rest of it next week. Jesus here says that he didn't come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. So how is it that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets? Yeah. So certainly the prophets, we get that, right? The prophets, in many cases, prophesied about Jesus. And Jesus himself recognized that he was the fulfillment of those prophecies. Luke chapter 24, verse 4, then he said to them, these are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things might be fulfilled, which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. So Jesus is the fulfillment of many of those prophecies. So that makes sense, right? So how is it then that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law? Okay. Okay.
Romans 8:3 says, for the law could not do it, and it was weak through the flesh, God did by sending his own son in the likeness of flesh on account of sin, he condemned flesh to sin, and it goes on. So there were things that the law, the physical law, could not do by design that Christ was to fulfill.
Man, I thought you were going to quote a verse from Hebrews. Because Christ is the fulfillment of the law in the sense that he was a perfect sacrifice. Because the blood of bulls and goats, that couldn't wash away sin, could it? I mean, it could move it down the line. And in the end, it was Christ's blood on the cross that was the fulfillment of the law in the sense of the necessity for a perfect sacrifice. Okay, we'll pick up in, we'll talk about that a little bit more next week as well. Let's take a short